them, Jean. I want another one. I feign complete ignorance. Morgan claps his hands together. All right, let me explain this in simple terms. We have an anti-Wernicke process. It works. We all saw Mrs. What's-Her-Face make the leap from babbling idiot to bunny rabbit enthusiast. Mrs. Ray, I say, she has a name. Whatever. Now we want the same thing, but different. Lorenzo rolls his eyes.
You want semantic opposites, Morgan?
If this jab bothers our boss, he doesn't show it. Maybe he doesn't get the joke. Morgan never was a shining star in the linguistics universe.
I want the opposite of what you've already given me. I want a neuroprotein that induces Wernicke's aphasia, and I want it by tomorrow. So get to work.
Lorenzo speaks first.
What did they promise you, Morgan? A lifetime membership to Washington's finest girly club? I didn't know you could get it up. Just give me what I want.
Every pair of eyes in the lab is now looking at us. No, I say. Morgan leans over until his nose almost touches mine.
Excuse me? I didn't hear you.
I said no. It's a negative, Morgan, a denial to your request, the opposite of agreement. For the first time since I've known him, Morgan laughs. It's a titter of a laugh, breathy and hollow.
It isn't a request, Jean.
He checks his watch, sighs as if this business is taking up more of his valuable time than he anticipated, and calls one of the patrolling soldiers over to our corner of the lab.
Corporal, take these two to room one and show them what's inside. When they've had a good look, bring them back here.
Room one is on the other side of the lab, through a set of locked doors, which might hold anything. I try not to think of Orwellian possibilities like rats and snakes. In any case, they're not my worst fears. My worst fears walk on two legs and have names like Sam and Leo and Sonia. My worst fears are my kids. The corporal, dressed in camouflage and combat boots, leads us to the steel doors. With his left hand, he also wears a ring, I notice, he slides a card into the electronic reader and stands aside as the doors slide open, revealing a vestibule and an additional door that remains closed as we leave the lab behind us. Only when the entry slides closed do I realize this space is like a tomb. I hate confined spaces. Always have. Lorenzo reaches over for my hand. His own skin is hot. The entire room is a furnace, and sweat trickles down my face in what has to be rivers of salt, burning me underneath the bandage on my cheek. But I don't feel warm at all. I feel as if an ice sheet has wrapped itself around me as the corporal steps forward and unlocks the next door. Inside, seated on the only furnishing in the room other than a lidless toilet, are three people. I think of the great apes, the hominoids, gorillas and orangutans, bonobos and chimpanzees, and of course, humans. The human on the left speaks my name. My old name, a name I haven't heard for 20 years. By the second syllable in Jeannie, a jolt of pain knocks her back into the steel wall. The sickening thud echoes in the room. It sounds like the muffled shot of a gun. 66. I lunge forward on unsteady feet, but Lorenzo catches me by the arm. His grip is firm, almost bruising.
No, he says. If she speaks again, the current will...
He's stronger than I am, but I break away, flinging myself at the woman on the bench, whose body sags like a lifeless doll under the harsh overhead lights. She's not how I remember her. Not in low-riding jeans and a crazily printed paisley blouse. Not smiling from under a fringe of color-of-the-week hair while she brewed herbal tea in a crappy Georgetown apartment and cursed at the IKEA table instructions that defied minds with multiple degrees. She's in a gray tunic that matches her hair and the color of her skin, except for the palms of her hands, which have been rubbed as raw as fresh meat from a year of labor that would make even the most stalwart farmer turn his back on the land and find a job pushing paper across a desk. She's wearing a single black band on her left wrist, where a charm bracelet of Chinese horoscope animals used to be.
Jacko, I say, placing one hand over her chapped lips. Jacko, don't say anything else. Don't let them make it worse for you.
Jackie Juarez, once the woman who I thought would stop the world, slumps wordlessly into my arms and sobs. The door behind me slides closed, then opens again. I don't need to turn to check who it is. I can smell the bastard.
Morgan, I say. Then I hear the slap, the surprised whine, the metallic click of a firearm being cocked. This is another thing I know about guns. You don't cock and aim unless you're ready to kill.
Careful, Morgan, I say, still holding on to Jackie.
You need him. You need his formula.
He doesn't, of course. Morgan already has Lorenzo's notes. I'm only buying time. And then it hits me. Lorenzo, dashing out of the upstairs lab to check his office, coming back and shaking his head to tell me the papers weren't there. Morgan demanding a formula by tomorrow.
Soldier, Morgan says. Put it away.
I turn from Jackie toward Lorenzo, who stands stock still, ready to take a bullet in exchange for a slap, and I realize Morgan can't possibly have taken the notes. So who the hell did? The question stays in my mind, but I tuck it back in a quiet corner for later as I turn to the other women in the cell. Lynn looks at me, then at Lorenzo. Next to her is the Argentine Swiss beauty who used to hang out in our department. She's still a knockout, even without the blonde waterfall of hair streaming down her back. Isabel Gerber. The two of them are in the same drab gray as Jackie, sitting hip to hip, hands folded in their laps. Twin black bands circle their wrists.
Caught them making out in a car, Morgan says. Fucking dykes.
Lynn opens her mouth to speak, then rethinks and closes it. The decision process takes all of a second, but it's there in her eyes. Over my shoulder, I catch Lorenzo's hands curling into fists.
Don't do it, Enzo. He's not worth it.
Suddenly, I wish I hadn't left the vial in my car. I'd take it out right now and shove the entire thing down Morgan's throat, glass and all. Or better yet, I savor the image of Jackie, Lynn, and Isabel locked in a small room with the bastard. A soundproof room, with no windows.
So, ready to work now, people?
Morgan says.
Or do I send one of them up to Fort Meade?
The expressions on the women's faces tell me Morgan has already filled them in, one vivid picture at a time. Time, I think. Everything comes down to time in one form or another. The time I didn't have 20 years ago, when textbooks and orals and qualifying papers were more important than Jackie's marches and Planned Parenthood tea parties. The 24 hours I'll wait before I find out whether the creature inside me is a boy or a girl. Lorenzo needing to leave while there's still time, although I'm not sure there is still time anymore, not for either of us. Morgan's hard deadlines, the morning meeting in only 18 hours. The time I slapped Stephen, and all the moments I'll spend wishing I could take it back. Morgan steps forward and takes three identical pink booklets from the inside breast pocket of his suit coat. He passes them out like playing cards, first to Isabel, then Lynn, then Jackie.
Don't forget to read your manifestos, girls, he says.
There's a nasty emphasis on girls.
Really, Morgan? I say. Hey, Jean, I don't make the rules. Take it up with Reverend Carl if you don't like it.
He looks at my wrist and laughs a hollow chuckle.
Better hurry before your bracelet goes back on.
Jackie, whose eyes are dry and looks like they have been this whole time, picks up the booklet from the bench next to her and, without so much as a glance at it, flings it at Morgan. It hits him square in the forehead with a satisfying thwack. He doesn't stoop to pick it up, but kicks it across the small room.
You'll learn, he says, and motions to the corporal to open the inner door.
Lorenzo takes my hand, helping me up from where I'm kneeling next to Jackie.
Stay cool, Jacko, I say. Promise?
She nods.
I'll do everything I can.
Everything I should have done, I think, as I follow Morgan out of the room and back into the hive of the lab. 67. There's a television in the lab, a flat screen the size of a football field. A reasonable size, I suppose, given that the kinds of men who buy these things spend most of their weekends watching other men toss a piece of pig around a 100-yard-long swath of astroturf. When Reverend Carl appears on it, dressed in his usual funereal style, it's impossible not to look at him. Also, someone has turned the volume up to a low roar.
"Friends,"
he says, opening his arms in that trademark way he has, as if he's Rio's very own Christ the Redeemer.
"Friends, I have some unfortunate news."
"I'll bet you do," I whisper to Lorenzo beside me. He's been busy at the stoichiometry again, a language as foreign to me as the words coming from the television.
"Settle down, please, settle down."
Reverend Carl's hands press the air around him down, and the murmur in the audience dulls. It's difficult to tell where he is, but the crowd is too large for the White House press room, and he's on a stage. The Kennedy Center, maybe, or the arena stage in Southwest D.C. More than a year has passed since I've seen anything that passes for live entertainment. Plays, the few that are performed, are either family-friendly drivel, censored down to unrecognizability, or off-limits to most of us. He continues on, reading out the Pure's manifesto, line by line, affirmation by affirmation, belief by belief. His current theme is suffering. It's one of his favorites.
"Friends, my dear friends, suffering is an inevitable reality in our earthly world. We are called to suffer for doing what is good at times, and no one suffers more than I at this moment."
A lengthy pause now, for effect. Reverend Carl likes to draw things out, suffering or not.
"We have here a lost sheep."
The camera pulls in close to his face, smiling and tear-streaked, then pulls back to show him extend his right arm and wave toward the wing of the stage.
"That's it. Come on now."
A lone figure emerges from stage right. I don't know whom I expect. Del Rey, most likely, or another Julia King, anyone. I don't expect my own son. The gasp of the televised crowd, if there is a crowd at all, it could be canned, is drowned out by the intakes of 50 breaths in the lab. Blinking under the floodlights, Stephen shuffles shyly toward center stage, toward Reverend Carl's outstretched arms.
"He's 17, I whisper to Lorenzo. "Only 17.
There's no need to explain. Lorenzo has seen pictures of my children. Once upon a time, those pictures littered my office.
"Caught," Reverend Carl says. "Caught in a place no man or boy should be."
He turns to Stephen.
"Isn't that right, son?"
Stephen starts to speak, then only nods. Rage boils inside me, through every vein and artery, until the pressure builds to a trapped scream. I miss most of the remaining speech. I can't hear anything except the sound of my own heart, deafening in my ears. The few words that make it through settle in my gut like lead weights. Fornicator, traitor, example, trial. Reverend Carl calls the audience to join him in prayer, bows his head, and takes Stephen by the hand. Another close shot pulls in, showing their intertwined fingers. Carl's are wrapped like tenacious constrictors. Stephen's are limp, five helpless digits having the life squeezed out of them. A few inches up from my son's hand is a wide metal band circling his wrist. A million years ago, it was only 20, but it feels like a million, it feels like tens of millions, like all the lifetimes of the entire world, Jackie asked me what I would do to stay free. Last night, over a kitchen counter that seems as distant as that Georgetown apartment, I asked Patrick if he would do anything, if he would kill. Right now, with a half-baked formula on the table and Reverend Carl scolding Stephen on the television, I put all the questions together and come up with a single answer. Yes, I would do anything. I would kill. The woman who thinks these words doesn't sound like me at all. Or maybe she does. In any case, I sort of like her, this new Jean. I like her a hell of a lot more when I catch Morgan smiling up at the flat screen. 68. At 5 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, on what should be a bright pre-summer evening full of barbecue smells and June bugs, Morgan informs us no one will be going home.
Cafeteria's on the 3rd floor, people. Dorms on the 6th and 7th. If you need to make a call, see Sergeant Petrosky.
Morgan nods to a makeshift security station at the entrance to the lab.
Nighty-night, folks,
he says before turning tail and striding out.
Stay close to the cages on your way through the chimp room, I call after him. The thought of Morgan having his face shredded by a few angry lab animals brings a satisfying tingle.
I turn to Lorenzo.
Petrosky's the key, I say. How's the work coming?
He leans against the back of his lab stool, smiling broadly.
It's done.
What? Lorenzo runs me through the chemistry.
I need your eyes on this, Jana.
He points to a set of correlations between the old neuroprotein we tested on Mrs. Ray and semantic fluency, then moves a finger down the page to the notes he's been working on this afternoon.
Look good?
It looks terrific. It also looks as if we've unleashed the very devil. With this quantity, Enzo, we're talking about total contamination, flat-out disruption of... I check the numbers against my data a second time. Of more than 3/4 of the superior temporal gyrus. Forget Mrs. Ray's disfluency. This thing would turn Henry Kissinger into a mute in about 5 seconds. The grin hasn't left his face.
Yeah, it's beautiful, isn't it?
Depending on what your idea of beauty is, I think. And I have a delicious idea that must be all over my face because Lorenzo raises an eyebrow.
I can cook this up in a few hours, I think. Got a first subject in mind?
What do you think? I say, scanning the lab. No one seems to be listening to us. What little chatter there is focuses on Reverend Carl and that poor kid. I wonder what he's done.
I think,
Lorenzo says, twitching one eyebrow and then the other.
Great minds think alike.
And sometimes we do, too. I finish. Anyway, better Morgan than one of the women in there, I say, and point my chin to the locked doors on the opposite end of the lab. You saw how many chimps are left. When they run out, Morgan's going to want to climb up the great ape food chain. Lorenzo stops chewing on the end of his pen and taps it lightly against his teeth. It's an old habit, one I haven't seen him do in more than a year.
There's one hitch, he says.
What, it turns people blue? I watch the humor leave his face.
No, not blue.
Oh, Christ. Lethal, I say.
Could be.
He points to a series of formulas on the notepad between us. They don't look anything like your old ones. As I read further, Lorenzo's work becomes clear. This isn't water-soluble, or injectable into the bloodstream.
Correct. Try that and you'll fry Huffy's brain. This needs to be administered locally, in situ, as Caesar would say. It's one thing to repair cells, overshoot the target and, okay, no big deal, you've got a few extra happy neurons. Destroying them is a different pile of wax.
Ball of wax. The correction comes naturally to me, so naturally I don't hear it over the single word screaming inside my brain. Trepanation. No way, Enzo. We'll never pull it off. Not only that, but the thought of wielding an electric drill within a mile of a human skull, even Morgan's, makes me ill.
Maybe not.
He checks around the lab, counting heads with the ink end of his pen.
50 people in here, not counting our boys in blue. A few of them look like they've been recruited young, straight out of school. But they're not that young, Jana. Grad students at the least. How about we take a walk around and read ID cards?
He points toward the lab entrance.
You take that end. I'll take the back. Nothing thorough, just a quick survey of titles, okay? Anyone asks, you're on your way to the security desk to call your husband. About the car.
Of course I need to call Patrick, since it doesn't look as if I'll be getting out of this building soon. He'll need the Honda, or at least what I left inside the Honda. I leave my 4-foot square workspace and start walking down the nearest aisle toward Sergeant Petrosky's desk. Slowly. I need to make a call, I say, to let my husband know I'm not coming home tonight. Petrosky smiles.
Sure, ma'am. Number?
I'll dial it.
Afraid I have to do that for you.
Of course he does. He probably has to speak for me, too. I'm right about this. Petrosky asks for the message and hands me a blank sheet of notepaper and a pen.
Just write it all down here, and I'll convey it, word for word.
The note's short. Pick up car, get Sonia's sippy cup. She'll have a meltdown if she has to go to bed without it. It isn't really a lie, not if you put some of the verbs in the past tense. I hand it over to Petrosky and blink 3 times. He blinks back.
Anything else, Dr. McClellan?
He says. I remember a different soldier sitting at this desk when Lorenzo and I came in, so Petrosky must have arrived recently. You're on duty tonight?
Yes, ma'am. Another graveyard shift.
My eyes move to his left hand. You're married, I say.
Of course he is. Yes, ma'am. 2 years this month.
His mouth curls into an embarrassed smile.
We were high school sweethearts.
I got married young, I say. I omit the fact that it might not have been one of the smartest relationship moves.
Had kids young, too. You got kids?
Petrosky hesitates, and the shy smile fades.
One. A girl. She turned a year old in April.
More quietly, he says,
1 year. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Look, I'm no scientist or anything. I got a high school degree and some community college hours. Then I joined up. Figured the army would give me a steady paycheck and all that. Plus, you know, if you make it 20 years, you get a pension, insurance and all that.
They do make it sound good, I say. He leans forward.
But I know something about kids. I'm the oldest, see. Have 5 brothers. Youngest one born when I was 15. Danny's his name. Good kid.
I nod. Sergeant Salt of the Earth keeps going.
Danny knew what no meant by the time he was 5 months old. Before he was 1, he could say Mama and Dada and Boo. Boo was the name of our dog. He didn't make much sense, but he was talking. And then,
Petrosky slaps the desk with the palm of his hand.
Bang! 2 words, questions, stuff like where Boo and want juice. It was like some kind of miracle, you know?
I do know. I watched 4 babies go through all those stages. Pre-linguistic babbling, 1-word holophrases, 2-word sentences, usually nothing more than a subject and a predicate. Then, in Petrosky's words, bang, it all started happening. At 3, Stephen would make demands. Take me to school in the morning. Please make chocolate in the afternoon. I also know the flip side, and so does Petrosky.
I saw this documentary once, ma'am, he says. Couldn't watch the whole thing. Too gruesome. These people, see, they kept their little girl locked up in a room and didn't talk to her for something like 12 years. 12 years, ma'am. You imagine?
I shake my head, even though I can imagine. It's happened in rare cases. Petrosky goes on, an armchair linguist who doesn't realize how right he is.
So you take a kid, any kid, and if you let them talk, they do it. If you don't,
another palm slam on the table between us. Bang.
That's it. Like they have some kind of clock inside them.
They do. No need to mention critical period hypotheses, also known as the use-it-or-lose-it theory, to Sergeant Petrosky. He gets the vibe without all the fancy jargon.
So my question is,
he says, looking straight into my eyes. His own are calm and blue, but there's pain behind them.
My question is, what's going to happen to my own little girl if she doesn't ever get to talk? Is she going to turn out like that genie woman? end up in some kind of home?
I have 1,000 answers for him, and none. Jeannie, the child in the documentary, never did learn to talk. After years of poking and prodding by linguists with more interest in the next big book than in Jeannie herself, the girl ended up exactly where Petrosky suggested, in some kind of home. When I've put the finishing touches on my message to Patrick, I hand it back to Petrosky. He grabs my hand.
Can you help? You're a doctor, right?
I nod, sort of.
Can you help?
He stops, looks down at the triple stripes on his sleeve, and says,
I took an oath, you know. Maybe we should write it out. This pure thing can't last forever.
Time to throw a log on the fire. You're right. It can't. It probably won't. Another few years and Reverend Carl will be another footnote in a history book. Of course, he might stick around longer.
Yeah.
Petrosky's on the fence. You know, Sergeant, I say, making it up as I go, hating myself a little as I stoke the flames. I read an article a few years back. We used to think kids had until 13 or 14 to, you know, for that bang thing to happen. But I'll tell you, as an expert, they have a lot less time than that. 3, 4 years, maybe. Afterward, their brains sort of... I search for the right word. Click off. His face pales, and I wince despite the fact that it's the reaction I'm going for. Well, I'd better get back to work, I say. Better, I think, to give him a few minutes to mull things over while I work out the details with Lorenzo. Leaving him and the key to the Honda at his desk, I walk back to my corner of the lab, this time along a different route. Half the ID cards are turned the wrong way, but I read a dozen of them, keeping in mind Lorenzo's advice to worry about the titles and nothing else. 69. Approximately 2% of the population holds a doctorate. If you ignore the PhDs in English, the percentage is less, much less.
I count 9, I say. Out of about 12.
Lorenzo must have been luckier than I with the ID cards.
I got 15 out of 20.
2/3, 3/4, it doesn't matter. We're sitting in a lab filled with experts. Given enough time, you could get a monkey to type out Shakespeare. In a lab like this, you could build a rocket to Mars in a hell of a lot less time. A brain-scrambling neurotoxin? I'd estimate overnight. Which is just in time for the morning meeting Patrick will be attending tomorrow. I check the room again. Eyes are exhausted, but busy. Lorenzo gives them until morning to come up with something that might satisfy Morgan. I think I've found us an ally, I say.
Yeah?
Over there, at the security desk. Lorenzo stretches his neck to see over the rest of the crowd.
You're kidding.
Petrosky might not be the brightest bulb in the box, but he's got 2 qualities I want. He's scared as shit for his daughter, and he's strong. That he wears a uniform and carries a ring of keys on his belt doesn't hurt. Take a look around, Enzo, I say. These guys have been working around the clock. They're dead tired. As I say this, 3 men, each of them looking to be in his 40s, file out of the lab, escorted by a single soldier.
Haven't seen my kids in a week, one complains.
Kids, another says. My kids are okay with it. My wife, on the other hand. If I don't get some food and some Z's, I'm gonna be toast tomorrow.
The third man looks as if he's about to fall asleep on his feet. See what I mean? I say, as another 5 worker bees signal they're ready to hit the hay. All we need to do is wait.
Wrong, Jana.
Lorenzo looks me over.
What you need to do is get some sleep, at least for a couple of hours.
I have as much chance of sleeping as I do of winning a Nobel Prize, but he's right. I've run into the fatigue wall at full speed, and my next lab task requires absolute alertness. 2 hours, max, assuming Morgan is staying the night.
He will be. Check in with your new pal on the way out.
Lorenzo cracks a smile.
And don't flirt too much. I'm the jealous type.
From the shelf behind him, he takes one of the tablets, swipes and taps a few times with those absurdly long but elegant fingers, and hands it to me.
A little light reading for you.
I read the title on the screen. Comparative neuroanatomy of primates, you call this light?
In the literal sense. The iPad weighs less than a pound.
How much does the book weigh?
It's about 500 pages. You want chapters 7 and 8.
He must see the unspoken questions in my eyes, because he keeps going.
Look, I'd do it, but I'd be starting from zero. Besides, I can't read that shit and set up everything down here at the same time. So brush up on your brain science, okay?
He turns to the computer behind him, pulls out the keyboard, and starts filling in a lab animal requisition form after consulting a chart of available subjects. In the space for the identification number, he types 413, then moves down the page to an empty block and starts hunting and pecking again. I watch him type sedation, trepanation, and intracranial injection of experimental serum Wernicke 5.2. Oh, man, I say, picturing myself with a drill in one hand and an iPad open to a set of step-by-step instructions in the other. This is so not what I signed up for. I'm not really the hands-on type, Enzo.
You're all I've got.
In the blank space where the requisition form says technician, he writes Dr. Jean McClellan. We have to, don't we? I say.
Either that or end up with a dead Morgan.
Lorenzo's mouth turns up at one corner.
Unless that's what you want.
Of course it's what I want, but there's no sense in being greedy. A mute Morgan will work just as well. All right, I say. I'm heading upstairs. Send someone to get me if I'm not back down here by 10, okay?
Deal.
I don't stop by Petrosky's desk for an escort. Instead, I head toward the soldier closest to him and speak loudly enough for my voice to carry. I need some shut-eye. Can you take me up to the dorms? While my escort calls out to the now half-filled lab, asking if anyone else wants the cafeteria or a bed, Petrosky motions me to him with a slight nod of his head.
I made your call, he says.
Great, thanks. I don't want to ask him for help. Better if the request comes from him. It does.
Anything I can do?
As a matter of fact, Sergeant, yes, there is. His face, smooth and whiskerless and innocent as a child's, lights up as I explain, in detail, exactly what I need him to do. 70. While Lorenzo is 8 floors down, sedating chimpanzee number 4 unlucky 13 and setting up the equipment we'll need, I'm sitting up in a narrow bed, fully clothed, digesting a stale sandwich from the cafeteria and chapter 7 of the primate neuroanatomy text, also known as detailed brain maps of our closest relative, the chimp. My squeamishness has fallen aside for now, mostly thanks to this afternoon's near mauling by 413's compatriot. I swipe a new window onto the iPad, check the database of medical journals for articles on craniotomy and trepanation procedures, and take a long, last look at the uneaten half of my sandwich. It's not the optimal companion for my bedtime reading, so I put the cheese on wheat aside until I review the components of my new friend, the crushing perforator drill. When I think there's no way I can bore a hole into an ape's skull, let alone a human's, I remember Jackie and Lynn and Isabel. Steel up, Jean. And I keep reading until my eyelids succumb to gravity and the iPad slips from my hands. The knock on my door seems to come at the exact moment I fall asleep.
Dr. McClellan?
The voice is muffled, cloudy.
Yeah. Time to go. Dr. Rossi says he needs you in the lab.
Everyone needs something. I need about a week's worth of uninterrupted nap time. Okay, coming. I peel myself off the bed, smooth down my clothes, by the looks of them I've slept hard, if not for very long, and open the door. It's Petrosky, and he seems to have aged a decade since I left him down in the sub-basement.
Have a good rest, ma'am?
My mouth makes the sounds of yes,
My pounding head argues. One foot follows the other down the hall, automatic marching orders telling them to take it up a notch, and I get into the elevator with Petrovsky.
All set,
he says.
Everything's exactly like you asked.
Good. Now, listen, Sergeant. Your job's done. The last thing you know is that Dr. LeBron accessed the lab at... What time is it now?
10:05, ma'am,
he says, holding out his left wrist for me to see.
Okay, LeBron entered the sub-basement lab at 9:50. He told you he had a headache, that's all you know.
In unsurprising military fashion, Petrovsky responds with a terse,
yes, ma'am,
and holds the open doors button as I exit the elevator. At the entrance to the lab, he pauses.
Please don't get cold feet now.
I can't be sure whether I'm talking to Petrovsky or to myself. He slides his keycard into the socket and waits for the green light, and I'm in. We pass the remaining chimpanzees, still hooting in their cages, and I note that chimp number 413's holding pen is empty, as is the main lab. Petrovsky's first job was to evacuate the sub-basement, which, judging by the unoccupied stools and the chaos of paperwork left on every flat surface, he did well. All it took was Lorenzo, a Bunsen burner, some foil, and a mixture of sugar and potassium nitrate. The biochem lab must have looked like a bomb went off. Well, that was the idea. I leave the sergeant at his security desk and walk back through the detritus of notebooks and calculators and reading glasses to where Lorenzo is waiting, half standing, half sitting on the counter where I left him 2 hours ago. He's the picture of cool, and I wish he didn't make it so easy to be in love with him.
Worked like a charm, Jana. Silent, smoky, and non-deadly. First thing I ever made when I got a chemistry kit was a smoke bomb. Ruined my mother's best pasta pot.
A devilish and boyish mischief flashes in his eyes. Boys, I think, they love to blow shit up, or at least make it look like they've blown shit up. He swings a leg off the counter.
You ready?
I don't know if I can do this, I say, feeling the cheese on wheat work its way in a direction it shouldn't be going. Where are they?
In here.
He opens the door to a side room. It's vacant, except for two gurneys and a rolling surgical table, covered in an array of stainless steel implements I've seen only in pictures. Pickups, retractors, forceps, something that looks like a melon baller. On the stretcher closest to me lies a 4-foot-tall female chimpanzee, her scalp partially shaved on the left side. On the other stretcher is a 5-foot-6 life form of a slightly lower order. Both are heavily sedated, their chests rising and falling in a steady rhythm. Petrovsky succeeded in getting Morgan to the lab. Lorenzo finished the job.
I think I like him better this way, I say.
Which one first? Lorenzo points to the chimp.
All right, bad joke.
But I need the humor to get through this. As soon as I see the craniotomy drill with its irregular steel bit, a little like a malformed tooth, I rethink. I don't need humor to get through this. I need a goddamned neurosurgeon.
Jana,
Lorenzo says. He checks his watch.
They're not going to be out forever.
I pick up the perforating drill and turn it on. It makes a low hum as the bit whirs around. There's no way this tiny contraption is going to bust through skull bone. I can't, I say, putting the drill down. So much for being willing to do anything. 71. I don't know how many times I've said I could kill him in my 40-odd years, maybe a few thousand. I could kill him for leaving the clothes in the washing machine. I could kill him for not calling to say he'd be late. I could kill him for breaking Mama's majolica vase. Could. Kill. Of course, I never meant it. The words are as semantically vacuous as I love you to death, and I'm hungry enough to eat a horse, and I'd bet my life the Sox are going to take a bath in this year's series. No one dies from love outside of a Bronte novel, or eats entire horses, or lays his life on the line for a baseball game. No one. But we say this garbage all the time. The fact is, I don't know whether I could have put down chimp number 412, even while he was going apeshit. I do know that I'm not taking a skull drill anywhere near either of the two sleeping hominoids on these gurneys. And I don't have to. Get Petrovsky, I say to Lorenzo. He stares at me. No, I'm not asking him to do it. I need the keys to room one. Again, the stare. To get Lynn out, and the others. Tell the kid I'll say we doped him up and stole his keys if it comes to that. But I think he'll play. I explain about the daughter.
I would, Lorenzo says. Play, I mean, if she were mine.
His eyes wander down my body, stopping at the slight swell where my waist used to be.
I wouldn't have left without you, Jana. Never.
Really?
Really.
He does a quick tour around the room, searching for anything that might be a camera, and kisses me.
Never.
Now you know how I feel about Sonia. And the boys. Sonia, mostly, though. Nothing is as bad as the idea of leaving her behind while everything goes to hell. Nothing except bringing another girl into the inferno. I push the thought out of my mind for the next 12 hours. Go on, get Petrovsky to do a little jailbreaking. 5 minutes later, Lorenzo comes back with Lynn. When she sees the two gurneys, she turns to me, open-mouthed and wide-eyed. I ask Lorenzo to explain, while I see to Jackie and Isabel. They don't need to be in here for what we're about to do. Hell, I don't want to be in here for it. Lorenzo informs me I don't have a choice. Lynn makes a thumbs-up sign with her right hand and thumps her left palm.
She needs you to assist, he says.
I look at Lynn's black bracelet. How'd she manage to say that? Lynn rolls her eyes, waves both hands back and forth in front of her chest, then sets the index and middle fingers of each hand together and points them at me, shaking them.
She says, never mind and hurry up, Lorenzo tells me. I'll translate.
You both know American Sign Language? I say. Why? He shrugs.
You speak some Vietnamese, right?
Yeah.
Why?
Okay, point taken. Through Lorenzo, I hear each of Lynn's instructions while we scrub ourselves up to the elbows in one of the biochem lab sinks. It's like brain surgery for dummies. Monitor vitals at all times. Pass me the tools handle first. Stay the hell out of my light. And in true Lynn form, for fuck's sake, don't pass out. The first three I can handle. I'm not so sure about number four. Back in the white room, it takes Lynn 2 full minutes to retract the skin on the chimp's head and another 30 seconds to bore a hole the size of a dime. She turns off the drill, passes it to me along with a hunk of chimpanzee skull, and signs to Lorenzo.
She says to think about it like the plug in a sink drain, he says, passing along this gem of advice.
Easy for you, Lynn, I say. I was always more interested in the linguistics half of neurolinguistics. She laughs, but her hands are too busy for chatter as she palpates the soft tissue inside the chimp's skull. It's stomach-turning and fascinating and miraculous all at the same time. How the hell could people like Reverend Carl and Morgan LeBron want to take this woman and throw her away? How could anyone think that makes sense?
Okay, here we go.
Lorenzo draws 2 full syringes of clear liquid from a vial on the surgical table. It looks as harmless as water. He sets one down on the table between the gurneys and holds out the other to Lynn. I watch her calm hands as she inserts the fine point of the needle a few millimeters into the chimp's cortical tissue and squeezes the plunger, glancing at the readouts. She nods, apparently satisfied she hasn't killed her patient, and injects the remaining serum before replacing the round piece of skull. Plug, Jean, it's only a plug, and stitching up her work. The entire process has taken 5 minutes. A good thing, really, since both the chimpanzee and Morgan have begun to stir. 72. One close-up and personal encounter with an angry primate was enough for me. I don't care to relive the experience. We need to get her out of here, Enzo. Now, I say, watching with horror as the chimp's chest begins to rise and fall more deeply. Lynn, how much time do we have before she comes out? Lynn shakes her head back and forth, holds up four fingers, then two. There's no need for Lorenzo to translate. 6 minutes, I say, hopefully. She shakes her head again, holding up two fingers, thrusting them toward me. I look around for something, anything we can use as restraints, and find only suturing thread on the surgical table. Not good. Okay, okay. No time to spare. Lynn, you make sure the cage is open. Enzo, you and I wheel this baby back where she belongs. My own heartbeat marks every passing second as Lynn races out of the makeshift operating room and follows the noise of the remaining hooting chimps toward the front of the lab. Chimpanzee number 413, eyes filled with puzzlement, reaches a long and hairy arm up to her head. Then she turns her face toward mine. Enzo, push! I yell. The gurney slams into a pair of lab stools, knocking them across the floor. Lorenzo catches one before it careers into two more, barely preventing a domino effect of rolling furniture that might block our path. Jackie and Isabel stand in the center of the lab, horrified and helpless. Don't say anything, Jacko, I plead. Don't say anything. Take Isabel somewhere else. Lock yourselves into a closet if you have to. Every mental image I have is of the mauled woman, Charla Nash, missing everything on her face save the skin on her forehead. Petrosky! I yell into the empty white space of the lab as Lorenzo pushes the gurney past countertops of flying paper, eyeglasses, a fucking slide rule. Petrosky! Petrosky comes running from his station. The chimp utters a low moan, not a hoot, not a screech, but a woeful, hollow moan. Don't look at her, Jane. Don't you dare look at her. But of course, I do. Fury shimmers in her soft brown eyes as we reach the open cage. Petrosky draws his service weapon. His hand shakes as he clicks something with a thumb. The safety, maybe? What the hell do I know? Don't shoot her unless you have to, I say. All right, Enzo, on my count. One. The chimp's paw leaves her head and reaches toward me. Two. I pant. Iodine from the wound fills my nostrils as she extends. Three. With every ounce of strength, I heave the beast off the gurney with Lorenzo taking most of her weight. A claw brushes my lips as chimp number 413 rolls into the cage. Lorenzo slams it shut and steps back to the center line of the cage room, taking me with him. One furry paw shoots between the bars, clawed fingers splayed, then retracts. The chimp goes back to massaging one side of her head. It almost looks as if she's trying to remember something. Oh God, Enzo. Morgan. Where's Morgan? Based on the tour, I know there's only one way in and out of the lab, and Morgan hasn't come through. Lorenzo is back across the room in four long strides as I yell to him to get Jackie and Isabel out of the way. I don't know if he hears me. Lynn signs something I can't understand, points to me, then to the caged chimp. Close one, I say, unsure of whether this is what she means. She nods. Go see about Jackie and Isabel, I say. I'm going to help Lorenzo. Another nod. I don't know whether it hits me while I'm still in the primate room, or whether I think it as I walk through the lab with its tilted stools and scattered papers, but it hits all the same. It hits like a fucking grand piano dropped from a high floor. Morgan. A syringe. Lorenzo. This isn't water-soluble, or injectable into the bloodstream. Try that, and you'll fry half his brain. My legs seem to move on their own. 73. Morgan LeBron stands 5'6" and might tip the scales at 150 after someone wet him down with a fire hose. Lorenzo can pick me up with one arm tied behind his back. It's no match at all, unless the smaller of the two has an edge. Morgan does. He has an edge with 20 cc's of poison and one hell of a sharp needle. And he's presently holding it to Lorenzo's neck, in that soft spot an inch behind the ear. Get out, someone says. I can't tell whether this is Lorenzo or Morgan yelling in the bright white room with one gurney and a table on wheels. It's only a voice, only two words that have no other purpose than to terrify me. Morgan, I start, He doesn't allow me to finish. You fucking bitch! Fucking cunt!
Lorenzo's jaw tightens, but the words don't bother me. The syringe, yes, but everything else Morgan has to push is nothing more than jumbled fricatives and velars. I can divorce myself from those. But that goddamned syringe, that's real. I take a step forward, very slowly, a sort of time warp step from an old sci-fi movie.
Jana, no!
Lorenzo sounds as rock steady as his body looks.
Jana? Who the fuck is Jana?
And as he says my name, my other name, Morgan's eyes flicker.
Oh, I get it. You two have a little something going on. Man, talk about two birds with one stone.
He's bordering on giddy now.
Oh man, this is too sweet. The poor, star-crossed, moon-eyed lovers. Tell me, Lorenzo, is she good? Looks kinda old from where I stand. But maybe you like your bitches run hard and put away wet.
The muscles in Lorenzo's left arm tense, and his hand curls into a fist.
Dr. Rossi.
Morgan pushes the needle's point harder against flesh. A pinprick of a red spot appears at the contact point, and a single drop of clear fluid rolls down the side of Lorenzo's neck. It's impossible to tell whether it's sweat or serum.
You know,
Morgan says, his voice syrup-sweet but still menacing.
I'm not much of a scientist. All that poring over data and running the same fucking experiments over and over again, I hate that shit. But I'm a good reader. A good people reader. And I can read other things, like that little bottle over there that says, local injection only.
He knocks his chin toward the spilled contents of the surgical tray without moving his eyes off me.
I saw that, and I had to ask, why? Why local only? What would happen if I pushed this needle in like so?
The needle buries itself a millimeter or two into Lorenzo's neck, far too close to the jugular vein.
What would happen if I just started pushing down on the plunger? Any ideas?
Go ahead, Morgan, Lorenzo says. Jana, get the hell out of here. There's a spare key under my car's fender. Take it and go.
Don't be so fucking brave.
Morgan's eyes, those nasty rat eyes, bore into mine.
You move, bitch, and I'll start pushing the stuff into him.
The eyes shift slightly to the left, over my shoulder.
Go back into the lab.
It takes a moment before I realize he's not talking to me. A firm grip, not as strong as a man's, but strong enough, tightens on my elbow, turning me slightly. Jackie. Her head moves in one sharp, defined jerk. Let's go, it says. In her free hand are Petrosky's keys. They sound like tiny metallic bells in the still of a room where everyone seems to be holding his or her breath. Get Petrosky, I say. Let's get this over with. It takes every part of my human brain to ward off the reptilian instinct to flee.
Don't do anything stupid, Jean,
Morgan threatens.
Listen, if you have a human bone left in you, Morgan, you'll do this right. Have Petrosky shoot him. Make it clean. You can always call it an accident later on.
There's a pause while Morgan considers this.
Self-defense, I suggest. The serum's going to be harder to explain. We're talking about a reputable biochemist here, not some schmuck you recruited from grad school. Think about it. Think what you're going to say when Lorenzo Rossi walks out of this building speaking in tongues. Then think about what the Italian embassy's going to say.
Morgan's thinking takes an eternity. I spend half of it thinking about guns. Like any mechanism, they have parts. The part you put a bullet in, the part the bullet comes out of, and the part that makes the bullet go from one place to another. Easy, simple, unchanged for centuries. Lock, stock, and barrel, in one order or another. During the other half of Morgan's thinking time, I consider Sergeant Petrosky, the philosophy major turned soldier, husband, father, a man whose hand shakes when he draws his service pistol, a man who knows where the safety is and how to disengage it. Jackie yanks on my arm again, and I turn to her.
What would you do to be free, Jacko? Because right now, I'd do just about anything.
She doesn't say a word, but she does smile.
Petrosky!
Morgan yells. Heavy boots echo through the lab. Under them, paper rustles. A sharp crack marks the end of a wayward pair of glasses. The entire world slows as Sergeant Petrosky approaches the open door behind me.
Sir,
Petrosky barks. It all happens in the blink of an eye, but I know my mind is recording each image, each still frame of the movie. Maybe one day I'll be able to slow these images down, replay them in real time. Right now, the sequence is haphazard and choppy, the soundtrack garbled.
Shoot this man,
Morgan says. Petrosky draws his service pistol. The gun is close enough to my ear that I can feel small perturbations in the air beside me, see the shimmer of Petrosky's hand as it tries to steady itself. Safety off, I say. The click is like a shot, automatic and deafening.
Now, Jackie.
She's on him. Petrosky's hand slackens. Later, I'll never know whether he cooperated or whether he was taken by surprise, but I make the move I planned, close my fingers around the grip, and aim a few inches below the blue pin glinting on Morgan's collar. And I squeeze. 74. Morgan falls and I fall with him, my ears screaming a note in the coloratura style as Jackie tries to catch me under the arms before I hit the ground. She's strong, or she was once, but gravity wins this game. I hit the floor with a thud I can feel but can't hear and realize I'm holding something. Lorenzo is at my side, his breath hot in my face. I see his mouth moving as he pries apart my fingers, disentangling the bulky steel from my grip.
Relax,
he says. The word comes out like he's talking underwater, but I can see the individual sounds. He re-engages Petrosky's pistol with the flick of his thumb, uses his shirt to wipe the grip and trigger, and hands it back to the soldier, who is leaning over Morgan and watching the blood bloom from his chest. A sickly scarlet puddle stains the white tile floor. Where'd you learn to do that, I say to Lorenzo. It sounds like...
Where you la to do that? 2 years in the Italian army.
Then, more seriously,
can you hear me?
I nod.
A little.
You'll have some ringing in your ears for a while, maybe an hour. It'll get better, trust me.
I heard him, didn't I?
Lorenzo checks over his shoulder to where Morgan lies.
Yeah, you could say that.
The words are still muffled, but slightly more intelligible.
We need to move him, I say.
Jackie's already thought of this. She's standing in the doorway with Lynn, Isabel, and an armful of suit jackets and lab coats, anything left by the men when they evacuated. She touches my arm, then gestures to the floor where Morgan is lying, points to herself, and makes circling motions with a finger. It's less elegant than the structured sign language Lynn and Lorenzo use, but I get the point. Jackie will take care of the bloody thing in the corner. Petrosky, slightly recovered from the shock, although I wonder if he'll ever truly recover, helps Lynn and Isabel roll Morgan and swaddle him in cloth while Jackie starts working on wiping down the room. It's a scene from a slasher movie. Blood on the floor and ugly Rorschach-like splatter on the wall behind where Morgan stood, holding Lorenzo at needlepoint. Lorenzo sees the look on my face and explains.
45 caliber, Jana. You blew a hole in him the size of Virginia.
I killed him, didn't I?
It's not really a question, more of a processing aid. I killed him. I killed a human being.
Yeah,
he says softly.
And we need to go. All of us.
Lorenzo and Petrosky drag the lifeless body of Morgan LeBron onto the gurney and wheel him out. I watch as the doors of room one slide open, then closed. A minute later, they're back in the main lab, minus one rolling stretcher. The six of us work in silence with bleach and rags, erasing the gore on the walls and floor of the room, tossing one blood and bleach-soaked rag after another into a thick plastic bag Lynn procured from a storage cabinet. From time to time, she and Isabel sign to each other. I can't understand it, but what they say looks comforting, hopeful. When nothing remains, save the stinging odor of chlorine, we file out and scrub what's left of Morgan from our skin. Lynn disappears and comes back with 6 clean lab coats, which she hands out. It doesn't take more than a glance down at my own clothes to realize why I need to cover up. Everyone else looks much the same. I turn to patrol.